j'ai plumé la tête de mon alouette.
J'ai plumé la tête de mon alouette.
J'ai plumé la tête de la queue.
Hello and welcome to Nerd Kitchen. This is Max Da Vinci. Today we have a very special guest, and to bring in that guest, let me start off with bringing my co-host, Ajit. Ajit, welcome to the show.
Hello, what's up everyone? And yes, I am really, really excited to introduce our guest. And this is a very special episode for many reasons. I think this is the first time we are recording across three continents. So that's kind of special. But I think even more special is the guest on our show today. It's the Dan Leppard. So Dan Leppard is a very, very famous, well-known, respected Australian baker, as his profile says, at least on Wikipedia. But I think he is one of those rare talents who has, ventured quite a bit in photography, followed by a career in food. So if I recall correctly, I think Dan joined and became a pastry chef with not so much of formal training, so to speak. And this was, I believe, in the early 90s. And since then, he's done some fantastic work. He's authored a lot of books. One of his first ones being Baking with Passion in 1999, which won the very prestigious Writers Guild, Guild of Food Writers Award. He also authored the Baking Chapter on the Cook book, which has won the James Beard Award. I could keep going on and on, but I'm afraid we'll spend the next 1 hour going through his biography. So I'm going to kind of stop the gushing here and say hi to Dan. Hello, Dan. Please say hi to our listeners.
Hello, Ajit. Hello, Max. And please don't stop the gushing. I love the gushing. I live for it. Thank you. Okay. Thank you. Gosh, when you were talking about, starting in the early 90s, and I'm thinking, my goodness, that's 30 years ago. And it's sort of, and even before then, the photography that I was doing then, and now in this COVID time, everyone's filming themselves and we're having to kind of create our own media. It's like my life has come full circle a bit. It's very strange.
So, so he's authored several books, and I think after pastry, I believe now he's into bread big time. So he's practically like a king of sourdough breads, and I think his books have this ability to, connect to an audience with its simplicity. But at the same time, if somebody wishes to, his books also talk in great detail about what happens during the process of baking. And that's obviously one of the things that is intriguing to us, because at the end of the day, we believe that, cooking and baking is some sort of a scientific methodology. But I think, Dan, let me start by asking, is it true that you did not have like a lot of formal training before becoming a pastry chef? So could you just go through the journey from, someone with not a lot of formal training to someone who, I think from the little I have seen, is quite obsessed with measuring every single milligram, be it a cake or a bread or even making roti?
You know, when I started, so I got my first job in a kitchen in, I think it was 1991. And at that time, pastry chefing was very low down the ranks of the brigade. You had this kitchen brigade, and right at the top is someone who cooks a piece or meat or fish. And down at the bottom was someone that made the salads, that made the starters, that made the desserts. And that's where I started. But I think within the first week, I realized that that's where I wanted to stay. I didn't want to progress on to cooking a steak, although I did during that year, but I still felt this pull back to wanting to make desserts, make pastries, make bread. And that making bread was one of the first things I did.
So that's really nice. And I guess once you start working with different kinds of chefs, I believe you worked with Yotam Ottolenghi a bit, and a series of folks. I'm assuming, so that was kind of like, baptism by fire, and then you started kind of getting trained a bit more formally in a more hands-on manner is what I'm guessing.
When I work with these chefs, they were simply the cooks that I admired. None of them were famous when I met them. Mm. And I'm not suggesting that my meeting them changed anything for them, but mm-hmm. I was always looking for people who I felt were like me. I was looking for an attitude that made sense. And that happened to be in talented, brilliant chefs. When I first went to work for, there's a chef, Fergus Henderson, who has a restaurant called St. John. And when I came back from New York in, when was it, 1994, I was offered two jobs. One in this Michelin kitchen. It was these young chefs that had worked with Marco Pierre White, and they'd set up this restaurant. Whoa. And they were going to be really Michelin. And then mm-hmm. over in the East End of London by the old meat market, there was this younger guy who had found this site that was an old smokehouse where they used to smoke meats. Mm. And they wanted to create a kitchen in there. And there was this, and this guy was Fergus Henderson. And there was just something magical about him. So for 1 week, I worked with Fergus in the day, this was in the pre-setup of the restaurant. And then in the evening, I worked on the pre-setup of this Michelin kitchen as the pastry chef. And at the end of the week, the Michelin kitchen offered me the job. And I said, no, guys, this just isn't for me. I really need to go to the other restaurant. And they said, oh, you're making a mistake. You know, we used to work for Marco and you know, he's a nobody. But he was a nobody who I admired, and that was the most important thing. And I would say to anyone, just go for the nobodies you admire, because they are somebody. And the restaurant, should I, just for anyone who's not aware of St. John Restaurant, it's one of the most famous restaurants in the world in its style of cooking, and it's gone on to become incredibly iconic. It's a tremendous restaurant. So do look up Fergus Henderson and St. John on the internet. And mm-hmm. I made the right decision. And then after that, I just kept going after people that I liked, people that I felt had qualities that I admired.
Now, that's really nice. I guess it's a very interesting thing that you mentioned, that, you know, earlier in career, it's kind of understandable to get caught with the glitz and glamorous positions, but I think this whole listen to your heart and you know, follow people that you like and work with them, and it's obviously led to a fantastic career for you. So that's really, really nice of you to, you know, say that, especially to people who are aspiring to be pastry chefs or bread bakers or cooks. So that's really terrific. Mm.
Yes, do that. I mean, look, you have. We often go into cooking to earn money. You know, that's the reason. We're doing it as a job, to earn money, to feed our families, to feed ourselves. But within that, you can earn money many different ways. And if you work for someone you admire, you always have that. You always have that reassurance. You have that sweetness when you go into work.
Yeah.
And wherever that's possible, do that. Because certainly in my life, it paid benefits over and over.
Yeah, I'm a big proponent of that, because I tell people as well, you know, even when someone from college asks me, oh, what should I learn? What's hot in the market now? And I tell them this, there's a difference between getting a job and a career. A job is something you just do to get by, but you make a career only when you love something and you work with people who you like. That's when you truly grow. And that's where you make that distinction, whether you're doing it just to get by, is this like a thing, or is this something that you want to do all your life? Then you do it with the people who you think, you know, you like, because otherwise it's not going to work out for you.
I absolutely agree. Absolutely.
Dan, did you always approach baking in general, be it pastry or bread, as some sort of a science, or have you initially approached it like some sort of an art and then you kind of learned and incorporated some sort of a scientific element to it?
Probably both things simultaneously, because first of all, I want to make the things I want to eat. Whatever I bake is something I want to eat. I would never bake anything I didn't want to eat or cook or in any way. I'm also fascinated by ingredients. Where I grew up in Australia was the outer suburbs of the city of Melbourne. And my parents grew apples and oranges and lemons and all sorts of carrots and cabbages and things. So and my mother encouraged me to be fascinated by them. She'd say, look, you know, look at this lemon, look at the shape of it, look at the thing. So I think I've always been, and maybe the photography comes in here too, that I was always looking at things and closer and closer. And out of that has to come a science too, because when you're trying to understand how you use these characteristics, you need to understand what they are. So say you've got a big knobbly lemon with a thick peel, and you need to find out, well, what is that peel and how can I use that? So if you want to remove the bitterness, maybe you need to salt it. Maybe you need to soak it and change the water. And then maybe to preserve it, maybe you want to get a sugar solution inside. So you in trying to grow the art, you need some of the science to do that.
Then just talk to us a bit more about some of these ingredients in say Australia, because I'm not sure if our listeners or even people in general are, you know, particularly aware of the general cuisine in Australia, for instance. So if you could just talk to us in a bit more detail about that would be really illuminating.
Well, absolutely. Australia is a country that people ran away to. They were often leaving their countries for different reasons. Maybe they didn't like their families, or maybe they didn't like the economy, or maybe they didn't like the politics. But typically, most of the people that emigrated to Australia were running away from their country. When they got to Australia, they then, to some extent, missed their country. Because when you leave home, you know, it's a tricky thing when you run away from home or leave home. You don't like your home, but you miss your home. So you want to recreate your home where you live. And then when you get older, you want to go back because you've missed everything. You know, it's just a bit crazy. And this explains the Australian psychology and dynamic, is that people are in this awkward place where they have left countries often. And are very proud of Australia and everything that's possible there, but they miss their home country too. So what this does to food is that you got immigrants traveling to Australia, say in the 1940s and 1950s, taking recipes and memories of food with them, and then they were kind of frozen in time. So you get a situation where there's techniques and old cooking ways that are continued within different communities within Australia that don't exist in their, in inverted commas, home country anymore. So there are techniques used in Greek cooking in Australia that you struggle to see in Greece, because the people that left Greece to make a new home in Australia kind of preserved their old ways, and their old ways became very important. And this, within this too, the idea of authenticity becomes very meaningful to Australians. They want to know what is the original way, but also they want to know what is the new Australian way. So they try to, in the Australian cuisine, always remember where things are from and then take them to a new place. So it's quite special, delicious food, and being able to grow all the ingredients you need makes Australia a special country. So say here, if you want to cook South Indian food in England, you need to import so many different ingredients in order to have that selection. Yeah. Whereas in Australia, you can, to some extent, grow them in your backyard. You can go outside and grow all the ingredients you need, and then, you know, you cook from the kitchen garden, so to speak.
It's interesting you brought up the Greek community, because I was reading somewhere is that Melbourne has the largest Greek community on the planet outside of Greece. And this is because of these migration patterns that you said earlier. Or similarly, I also was reading that in Sydney, there's a suburb which has the most Thai restaurants outside of Bangkok. And this is because of people who've come in, but they like the Australia. And so they're bringing their cultures with them, and they're all, kind of stuck there, and then they're growing there. And it's also interesting because Australia is so unlike most of these other places. And not many listeners may know that, because Australia is this huge anomaly. It is the world's largest desert island, right, to start with. And almost 80% of the population is among that eastern seaboard of Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane. So everyone's right there. And you have, like you said, because you have that tropical climate also, which helps. You can grow whatever you want. So because you're so far away, trade is there, but you are more reliant on growing everything that you can, or foraging things that are available, which is why I think I wanted to see if you could shed light on how local produce or the local catch from the oceans has come in into any of these traditional cooking in these dishes. Or, you know, do you think, like, because I'm guessing, like, in Greek food or Thai food, they still use the catch that they get from the oceans, you know, like the crustaceans or things like that.
Oh, absolutely. So there's certain iconic Australian ingredients. So one is a freshwater crayfish, a tiny one that's called a yabby. And yabbies appear, you might find a Malaysian dish with yabbies, you might find a Thai dish with yabbies, you find, because as soon as an Australian customer sees things like yabbies, they sees things like, there's certain ingredients that are put in to almost sort of ring a bell for Australia. The only thing I can think of. Like, say, at the moment on the internet, there's this infuriating and complex argument about there's a chef in America, Christina Tozzi, and she's made this round bread that has layers of butter and dough around, and she's called it flaky bread. And loads of people, particularly people from India, are saying, why didn't you just call it paratha? Why couldn't you just say, I didn't make this up, I didn't invent flaky bread, it's actually a paratha?
Yeah.
Well, my recollection of a flaky bread like that is a roti canai, because the Malaysian community are so big, particularly in Melbourne, that's where I encountered it. And there's one chef in Melbourne that makes the roti canai, but instead of serving it with a curry, he serves it with a kind of dip of something called Vegemite. I don't know if you've heard of Vegemite. Vegemite is...
Is it like Marmite?
It's like Marmite. Okay. It's like Marmite. And he makes this puree of Marmite. So he serves the roti canai, which is like a paratha, which is the Malaysian version of a paratha. But he serves it with Vegemite. And it's kind of his version of Vegemite on toast. And it's completely delicious. So, and it's fun to say that too. So we try and put Australian ingredients wherever we can into a menu, in order to say, you know, we're proud of our country as well as all of these dishes.
It's interesting you mentioned Vegemite, Dan, and I think you should shed a little more light on that for our listeners, because it is so unique to Australia, but also what is exciting for me is how it comes. It's leftover yeast from the extraction of beer production, and that is mixed with this vegetable extract. The malt comes from the barley, and then that's what makes it that thick paste. But I think it's salty compared to the British Marmite, which is more sweeter, isn't it?
Yes, it's incredibly salty. And sadly, they've changed the formulation, because when I was growing up, it used to be like a black butter. So if you dug your knife into it, it would scrape out, and you a little bit like a thick peanut butter, it would hold its shape when you took the Vegemite out. Whereas now they've changed it and they've made it gummier, so it's a bit more like a syrup, and I don't like the way it is. It's very difficult to eat. It's very salty. It's as salty as, I don't know, anchovies. It's sort of, it would, I mean, in its intensity, it's almost like eating a Thai red curry paste from the jar. It has that kind of, I don't think I should be eating this kind of reaction. I should be using this in some way. So what we do is get our knives and spread it incredibly thinly on toast. That's the way the Australians have it. If ever you see it spread thickly, you know that person is foreign. They're not from Australia. Because okay. No Australian would ever put it thickly on toast.
Yeah, I've seen it on an episode of the Australian MasterChef. The whole concept of a yeast-based spread is very unique, to me at least.
Where did it come from? Yeah, yes, I don't know how. It was probably invented, I would have thought, in the 1920s and 30s. There was a kind of inventive time that possibly paralleled the Great Depression. We started to try and get more food out and avoid waste. And possibly we're going to be going into a similar time now. If the world is going into a depression, we're going to start, in a way, being very creative and looking at excess things and saying, well, could I make something of this? So it's possible tomorrow's Vegemite is being created right now somewhere in Australia. Yeah.
Another one I wanted to ask you about, and because it's so indigenous to the region, is kangaroo meat. What's the thing with it? Because it is a pretty big delicacy across restaurants, isn't it?
It is. Many people eat kangaroo meat. In Australia, I've had kangaroo tartare. So like beef, like raw beef, chopped up on a plate with raw kangaroo meat. Yeah. It's very intense. It's like venison that is full of natural hormones. It has a very strong flavor. Perhaps even in this COVID time, people are starting to question whether they need to eat quite as much meat as they have been. And maybe we should be eating more vegetables. So maybe it would go that way. But yes, kangaroo is widely eaten in Australia. You can buy it at many supermarkets. Now tell me, Max and Ajit, were you brought up in families that were vegetarian?
Yes, I grew up vegetarian. And when I came to the States, it was difficult at first. And now it has become more fun for me to stay vegetarian. And it makes it easier when you go to a restaurant because there's only one thing on the menu you can order. but also I would say that me staying vegetarian has actually launched me into this whole culinary journey of myself, is because I'm vegetarian, the options that when you go out are far lesser, which is why then I'm looking at home. How can I make this? How can I make that my own way? So then that's how a lot of my cooking has come. So and people who know me will say, like, things that I make are just things that I see. I go to a restaurant, I see something, this is nice, or I watch a show, this is interesting. But yeah, you know, they've used fish in this. What can I do with not using fish? So it's more, a lot of my cooking has come because of being vegetarian, not having options, or the options that are there, you know, are really expensive. And then having to work with that has kind of made me a cook. And I think if I had come, when I came in as a student, if I started, you know, screw this, I'm going to have that slice of pepperoni pizza, then I don't think I would have gotten that much into cooking as such, because then there are so many options at a stone's throw.
That's a good point. And Ajit, do you eat a lot of dairy and eggs, or is it mainly vegetables and grains?
So I think like Max, I was also raised a vegetarian, and I think in my case, I know my parents are a bit more orthodox, so they are fairly clear that, you know, no meat in the house, and when they go outside, I think even today they insist on going to restaurants that don't serve any meat, at least when they head out to eat in India. In the US, of course, they have to adjust, be a bit more accommodating. And while it was not strongly suggested that it is because of religion or the kind of community we belong to, But at the end of the day, even I kind of realized that when you don't have that option exposed to you, you know, eating meat as an option is not, you know, exposed to you, you don't tend to ask questions. You're like, this is the world of food as I know, and therefore let me live within this world. Only when I, you know, went out and started meeting different kinds of people and started living in different countries, I realized there is a huge world of food out there that is not really veggie. And being a scientist, I had to at least try to learn. And I realized that, you know, because, and this is the thing about India, how it's represented across the globe, right? Because I would imagine 10 to 15, and even now, right? Because anytime you say, I'm from India, the first question is, are you Hindu and are you a vegetarian? And which kind of, it's a bit bothersome because I have no reservations in stating that India by and large is not a vegetarian country. People eat their share of meat. It's just that there is a sense of balance. It's not like, you know, I want to have chicken for lunch and then, you know, goat meat for a snack and then a pork for dinner. It doesn't work that way. But it is true that majority of Indians do eat meat. And so I kind of really learned a lot. And I realized that, you know, a country like India is incredibly diverse in terms of its meat eating habits. We eat cows, there is buffalo, there is chicken, there is a particular variety of chicken which is also known as a black fowl. The flesh is actually black, it's a very rare kind of chicken. We make chutneys out of ants, we have pork. I mean, you practically name the meat, there is duck. So you name the meat and chances are we would probably have it in some part of India. There is camel meat that's consumed, there is horse meat consumed. And not only that, I think the different body parts of meat are consumed. I mean, you obviously have the rich cut. But I came to realize that, you know, we also use the brain, the liver. And so essentially, and to me, it's not like, you know, eating these weird things. It is inherently to me a question of sustainability. Like if you have an animal that you're consuming, it makes complete sense to make use of every part imaginable because there is some nutrition in it. And why, you know, throw it in the ground? Because that's just wasting food. And I think that is another common theme that binds different countries that, you know, hey, food is quite frankly, we are privileged to have the kind of food we are having today. Whereas there are millions of people who don't even get a proper morsel to bite. So,
absolutely.
It is kind of a sin, if you will, to waste any form of food. And this whole reading upon different kinds of meat really, really opened up my eyes and opened up my horizon.
And tell me, Max, you must see in America there are these people that call themselves paleos that are really big on eating meat as part of their diet and are convinced that the rest of us are killing ourselves by eating you know too many vegetables or too many grains and things like this. Do you think it's a bit crazy that these people are kind of possessed about eating meat when there's so many wonderful vegetarian things to eat?
I have an opinion on this and might not resonate well with a lot of people, but I think I always feel that diets come from a place of privilege.
Yes.
Right? You have to be privileged enough to say that you want to be on a diet because for a poor person, a diet is not about something that he or she wants. It is like, it is a way of life. It's unfortunate. But when you're coming from a position of privilege, a diet is something that you can say that you don't want to eat something or like Ajit said, a lot of people have difficulty in food coming their way. So any of these, the paleo diets or people who do these keto diets, it is pretty expensive to sustain a ketogenic diet or a paleo diet or any of these other things that come up as the flavor of the season goes. And which is why I, and I've spoken to this multiple times with Ajit as well. And I always say is that eat everything that you can, just moderate the portions of what you eat. Yeah. And Ajit, one of our previous episodes, just said this brilliant. He's like, if you want to have a slice of cheesecake, eat a slice of cheesecake, but then that's it. And if you have portion control, that's all you need. That's my opinion on any of these diets. And even paleo, like it sounds good on paper where you say, you know, you eat like the cavemen did. They did not have access to any of these, you know, pre-produced things. And so you eat like how a caveman did, but it's not sustainable. you cannot do that unless you know you're fairly well off.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, just to let the vegans off the hook, when how do you know that somebody bakes sourdough? They'll tell you, and they will tell you at some point. And I told you about my starter. So, do you bake any sourdough breads?
So I have dabbled with sourdough. I actually have a starter sitting in the fridge. So I feed it quite regularly. Although I am not taking as good a care as I should, but I think it's doing all right. So yes, I have given sourdough a shot. And in fact, one of our earlier episodes, during our early days, we had a guest called Anita, who is really good with sourdough breads, and she also conducts a lot of workshops. And she's a really good friend, and I had a chance to attend one of her workshops, which is where I really fell in love with sourdough. So the whole concept of let the time do the work for you instead of you needing like a maniac all the time, which is how I went about bread earlier. But I like both my breads. So I love the sourdough stuff where you let the time do the work for you, kind of nice and slow and easy. You, as long as you have a good starter and it's as basic as it gets, to the typical yeasted breads. I personally like them both. But yes, I have dabbled with sourdough a little bit in the past.
And how about you, Max? You're living in New York. Isn't it compulsory to have a sourdough starter?
I'm in Detroit, Motor City.
Oh, Detroit! But... Oh, you're let off the hook then.
No, but it's actually funny you ask that, because I don't bake at all. Like my wife is more of the baker in the house. I don't know what to do with yeast. I can't even get yeast to proof. That's what I am at that stage, and it's not something I cannot. I just have not, you know, dabbled into it, because she loves baking, and it's also what kind of a person you are. Like, my wife is really big about measurements and weights and things and all that, and baking is, you know, a science. With me, I more like, let's just see how things work. And I don't think that attitude kind of works with baking, because a lot of baking, it has to do with pressure, precise measurement. So even when someone asks me a recipe, I don't give people exact, saying half a cup of this, 3 ounces of that. It's like, no, yeah, add some of this, add some of that. For me, it's more about the process of cooking than, you know, the ingredients that go into it or what goes. It's, for me, it's more like, does this work with that? How about, so like, because, you know, we're Indian, and we don't get a lot of produce that you would get in India here. So like, for example, India has a lot of varieties of spinach. So growing up, there were a lot of different varieties of spinach, and my mom would make, these dals kind of with them, and they would all taste different because you have so many different greens. You have amaranth greens and all these other things. Here, it's not that possible. You don't get those. So for me, my whole thing is I try to recreate dishes that, you know, with flavors, try to impart the same flavors that my mom would have made, but with what I get here. So I subscribe to a CSA, and so I get French sorrel. I'm like, okay, I'm going to mix what I'm going to see what I want to do with that. Or making things like with asparagus, or we used to use like these runner beans back in India that you would get to make a curry. I don't get that here, but I'd say, what if I can use asparagus? So for me, my culinary journey is more of experimenting with different ingredients to see if I can make things that, you know, I would like to eat. Baking is something I've gone into because of that, because it's a very precise science and you have to do it exactly the way it's meant to be.
So I just wanted to mention one thing about diet, since we were talking about that. See, it also depends on why do you want to go on. If you have a genuine allergy or something, or some kind of condition that prevents you from having something in particular, that's absolutely fine. Also, I think one thing about diets is that, see, if you're trying to, for example, control the weight of your body, you want to lose or gain, more than likely it's about losing weight with a particular diet. And therefore, the question that needs to be asked is this something that I'm going to follow till I reach a certain target that I have in mind, because that's about increasing or decreasing a weight. And then there is an element of, okay, I have reached my target weight. Do I want to maintain that? Because the diet requirement for the two stages could be significantly different. So if you want to go on a diet to prevent or address a certain existing condition, that is one conversation. But then if you want to say that, for taking paleo as an example, as a lifestyle choice forever, that is, I don't know, a bit perhaps odd to me, because I would like to think that while we were cavemen, but the key word there is were. I would like to think that we are no longer cavemen. We have the, I don't know, since fire was invented, we have evolved in terms of our body structure. There is a reason now why appendix is actually a vestigial organ. So our body has also evolved. So to think that, you know, we are in principle similar to cavemen in many ways is a bit odd, because, I mean, that's why I think we are also 99% similar to the chimpanzees, but that doesn't mean we start leaving our apartments and start hanging off trees or something. So we need to at least make an effort to evolve with time and make sensible choices with our diets, is pretty much the way I look at it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Dan, so now we've talked about the different kinds of diets, and, you know, we've essentially kind of trying to differentiate, you know, okay, that is a particular kind of diet. And I think we've also, it goes without saying, when we were talking about this thing earlier, that, you know, when a person of a certain ethnicity makes a certain kind of a preparation that doesn't, belong to that particular ethnicity, to phrase it loosely, there is some element of, there's an element of looking differently, or there is an element of subconscious bias, if you will. So why don't you share your experiences on, you know, what kind of discrimination did you face, and let's kind of really open up that that particular topic for discussion.
I noticed particularly in baking and bread baking, and maybe even sourdough baking, is that it's a bit of a bro thing. It's a bit of, you know, it's about these straight guys, and it's their muscles, yeah, and their tattoos, and there's this whole kind of machismo about their sourdough baking. And I'm not like that. Yeah. You know, I had a dear friend who was saying to me, you know, maybe you could butch up your presentation a bit more. Maybe you could a bit more kind of, you know, tattooed and things. And I understand where they're coming from, but I don't know. I think part of my strength is in not maybe looking at things as an outsider. Maybe, and always feeling as an outsider. Like when I was working in kitchens as a gay man, I found I didn't really fit in. I didn't really fit into the conversations. I didn't really fit into the sexism. I didn't fit into the demeaning attitude that the head chefs would have towards the waitresses. I just couldn't associate that with that in any way. So what I tended to do was keep my head down and work. So while they were sort of groping and all the horrible things that were going on, I did my work. I kept my head down. I didn't know how to, I say with some guilt, I didn't know how to, you know, stand up for the situation. So now I'm outside of it. I'm much more concerned that we need to, that the best kitchens allow a diversity in them, because when you bring in people of different mindsets, of people with different backgrounds, of people who have different life experiences, they're going to bring some of that to their cooking. Like Edgett, you were just talking about, you know, so two of you, and Max, growing up in households where there was a normality to eating vegetarian food. So if you were to go and work in a kitchen, you would bring that sensibility with them, and a chef would be stupid to ignore that. You know, surely you want to encourage your employees to bring their individual skills into the workplace to make it a better workplace, you know, so the menu becomes different. You know, whereas to obliterate that and to say, look, only my ego matters is a terrible thing. And sometimes, sadly, that is this white, straight, male ego that's making the decisions. Too often. I think we can make kitchens better by making them more diverse and allowing the power within those kitchens to be spread between with everybody.
But isn't it also on lies with the public on their acceptance of chefs and cooks like that? So, for example, let's say, like I was saying, right? You have chefs from various ethnic backgrounds, whether they are Asian or African, so on, setting up restaurants. But it's just that inherently, people are kind of, they're wired that, yeah, they're probably just going to make, they're expecting something that, borders on their ethnicity. So they're expecting,
like
an Indian chef sets up, a restaurant in the heart of Britain, people are still expecting it to be an Indian restaurant. I mean, he could be trained in France or somewhere else, but they will still expect him to bring, put an Indian spin or an Indian flavors on something else. So even and it's same even for like for African chefs or so on, but that doesn't work the reverse. Whereas let's say someone like a Ramsay or any of these other guys, they go and set up restaurants, and in their restaurants, they serve Thai food, Chinese food, and some Mediterranean dishes, and people are like, oh wow, this person can make all these other cuisines. However, when you have people coming from different ethnicities, you're kind of pigeonholing them and expecting them to only do that. And I was reading about it also, is that there are very few people who kind of try to go beyond that, but then the acceptance from the general public isn't there, which is why they end up having to kind of close down their restaurants and so on.
It is, yes. We want so many different groups of people to stick to their lane and not to move outside it. And I think that is a shame. Look, I feel guilty of it. Even in the conversations with Ajit, we were having these chats online, and I was saying, well, can you teach me this Indian bread or that Indian bread? And I wasn't saying, well, I wasn't saying to you, well, what are your skills? What would you like to teach me? And then, because maybe you make extraordinary pasta, great gnocchi. Maybe there's a patisserie thing that you've really got. So I think, yes, we do it. We expect people to do things. When I'm in Japan, I teach a lot of classes in Japan. They want me to teach them British food. They want me to teach them British cooking. And I get the sense that people would like me to stay in my lane there because I'm British. Why would I teach them anything else? Why would I teach them how to make a genoise? Or why would I teach them how to make pasta? Somehow we have to juggle or hold in both hands this idea that someone should be allowed and maybe given the first opportunity to demonstrate and celebrate the food from their diaspora, but also to be able to have a life beyond that, a work life beyond that. I think we need to allow both things. I know in my heart, if I wanted to understand Indian food, I have this instinct that I would turn to an Indian chef first. And I've been attacked online about this, thinking, well, you cannot use that as the benchmark for finding the best chef. But maybe I'm not looking for the best chef. Maybe I want to give an opportunity in what I'm reading and what I'm looking to the person who knows that food so well.
Yeah. And that's fine when you're just asking people and trying to go. I think where it becomes important is when you're going to eat And this is something resonates well with me based on what Ajit said. Food is something, like the dish that is in front of you, right? That is bringing so many different ingredients and flavors that went into make that, say, that one dish. And you savor it, in whatever dish it is, you know, from whatever part of the world. But then it's about dissociating your mind and putting your biases away, because just like so many ingredients and dishes and flavors that went into making this food, same thing happens with people around. We see that with the food. We appreciate the food that we eat. And you know, we say we're getting the sweet parts, we're getting the sour parts, all of that. But that same level of appreciation we don't have for people around us, because people also, just like that, they're from all parts of the world, from various cultures, there's diversity, where, you know, genders and so on. But we don't have that same level of appreciation for people as much as we have for the food that we're eating in front of us.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think it's been said by other people, you know, that say in Britain that we love Indian food more than we love Indian people. And that's a sad fact. If we showed the same excitement and the same joy about the people as we do about the food, the world would be a better place. Absolutely.
So I think, yeah, it's kind of unfortunate that, you know, food is supposed to be a unifying force. I mean, when people, like you said, you know, Australia is such a melting pot of different kinds of cultures, so are a lot of other countries. And I think one thing when you're traveling away from home, one thing you really miss other than people is the food. So when you kind of share that knowledge and food, to me, food is probably the biggest unifying force on earth, even more than, you know, say a sports or any form of arts or entertainment. To me, food is probably the biggest unifier on this planet. And it's really sad that, you know, all our prejudices, be it based on our lifestyle choices, based on our dietary preferences, based on, you know, whether you eat meat or not, or whether based on your sexual orientation, it is really unfortunate that all our prejudices start creeping in, and that kind of makes the whole thing quite unfortunate.
Maybe there's an opportunity here. Maybe there's an opportunity, particularly in this COVID time where everybody is trying to learn new recipes. Maybe we have to balance that with, we need to learn about another person. Maybe in the way that we need to, for one recipe, learn to chat and understand as we're doing now with other people. Maybe that's the way forward out of this.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, if a calamity like this won't teach us to unite and shed our prejudices, I don't know what else will.
So, Dan, I have a rather vague question, but please do try to answer it as much as possible. And when you think Chinese food, right, the first thing that comes to a lot of people's minds is takeout. Same thing when you think Indian food, the first thing that comes to everyone's mind is, again, some curry chicken, but again, it's takeout. But when I say Italian food or French food, the images that come to people's minds are like fine dining and so on. So I'm not questioning why it is the way it is. I think I know the answer to that. But my question more on the lines is, do you think, and because of your travels and the number of people you'd meet and interact with, do you think there will come a time, and if so, when do you think, where these other ethnic foods will be treated the same way as people, you know, in reverence as people have Italian or French cuisine these days?
Well, I think using the general term Indian food, and of course that is so, yes, such a big term that it's almost useless. But if we just stick with that I think what we're seeing in England, Indian chefs who are able to present their food in something more refined than a takeaway container. We're allowing them to have the same eloquence in the way that it's presented, that we expect perhaps from, as you said, from French food, from Italian food. But it's complicated. I mean, you know, part of me actually doesn't, I've kind of had enough of eloquent food. I've kind of had enough of designs on plates. I've kind of had enough of chefs imitating other chefs in the style of their cooking, whether it's, and I've really had enough of this high-end sort of Michelin type cooking. I really don't want to eat it. I don't want to have another degustation menu. I really don't. I've eaten enough for a lifetime, and I really don't want to go there. I want to eat kind of casually now. Mm-hmm. So though I want there to be more opportunities for chefs from different communities to present their food however they want to, I also don't want them to be burdened with the cost and the debt of wanting, sure, feeling that they've arrived and be recognized by the press by the way that they by the china that they use, by the way things are plated. I think what I'd like is us to move beyond this pomposity and actually appreciate the chef in the what do you call them, these kitchen, the windowless, the dark kitchens. I think that there are so many extraordinary cooks that work in simple cafes that work, in fact, maybe better because they don't have the staff, they're having to work on their own. And I think we have to move beyond this biased thought that when a chef is in a very expensive dining room, they are a better chef, because that's just not the case.
And maybe it's a function of the press as well, and the media, because, like, for example, I now know about pasta from all the different regions of Italy. I mean, Italy is not that big a country to start with, but still, I, because of media and the press and the coverage that it gets, I know now, okay, these are different types of pasta which come from the different regions of Italy. Whereas, like you said, when you take Chinese food or Indian food, that itself is, because the regions in both these countries are so diverse that what's eaten in the northern part of India is completely different from what's eaten in the southern parts, or similarly for China. You know, what the provinces eat are totally different. However, what is brought over from the east to the west is only food from one particular region. Yes. So yes, same thing goes for China as well. It's more maybe from the Sichuan region.
Or Cantonese, so yes.
And for India, it's more from the northern part of the thing, which is where you get all these butter chicken, paneer butter masala, and those kinds of preparations from, and which then lays that blanket over an entire region, saying or an entire country, saying this is a representation of what your food is, despite being, you know, rich and diverse in other things.
Absolutely, and often to do with PR companies and the way that the sort of promotions that chefs are able to enjoy. And it is also true that those benefits aren't shared equally amongst people of color and Asian chefs. I think that if you like, the corruption and the bias only really applies to white chefs. I don't think, not that I'm encouraging it, but it is, it's a white corruption.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying I don't want an Indian Grand Acads. It's more about, like I said, it's just people learning about different dishes and cooking. And so, which is why, like, I loved that when you did that Instagram live with Ajit, people know naans, like everyone knows what a naan is because you've eaten in tons of Indian restaurants across the globe. You get a naan in every Indian restaurant on the globe today. But the adai, like, it is tasty. It is, you know, it is rich in nutrient because there's all the beans that go in it. But those are the more underappreciated or unappreciated dishes which nobody knows about. Mm. You just think, okay, there is a naan and there's a chicken curry, and that's kind of what it is, with fatty food. But then there are these other things also, which, again, they don't have to be beautiful. I mean, ugly is delicious, but just trying to get the word out on all of these other things as well.
Yes, very much, very much. Well, I'm here to do that, guys. Just tell me, just inspire me. And it doesn't. What I need to say too, you know, I wasn't getting hung up on meat eating too. When I look at all the things that you're cooking on your Instagram stream, I'm so excited by the vegetarian food. I think that there's a whole world of within Indian vegetarian cooking that we just don't know in any way.
That's really sweet of you to say. And I just wanted to also kind of have a perspective on the whole connotations associated with, say, French cuisine and Indian cuisine, so to speak, right? So the way, I mean, I this is my opinion, and do feel free to correct me. See, when we talk about French cuisine, it's like a process, right? And there is a certain technique of handling certain things, and the measurements are really, really precise. And I'm not talking desserts, right? If you have a certain sauce, the five base sauces, or the way to cut this meat, it has to be this way. It has to be done with this kind of a knife, and it has to be done for this amount of time. And you have to use this, mass of stuff in your cooking. So the recipes are really, really set, and that's how I believe things kind of evolve, right? So it's like the recipe is set, and any deviation, I don't know, perhaps it's looked upon as it is perhaps looked upon as an imperfection, as opposed to embracing it as an element of diversity. And in Indian, typically in Indian households, I'll be shocked if any mother measures, or any whoever is cooking. But of course, in household, it's still majority of the cooks are women. And you know, I mean, my mom almost never measures anything. Neither do I. If I'm cooking, and I'm not talking about baking or pastry, I almost never measure. I never say, take half a cup of flour and half a cup of lentil and add 2 teaspoons. It's really touch and go. You just have a basic idea of what you want to do. And this is where I think also the diversity comes into picture, because a lot of different regions have different agricultural practices and different kinds of climate. So can I grow the same spinach and wheat and rice everywhere? Absolutely not. So how do I now try to put my own spin on? I mean, let's take that Ardai for an example. I don't think there is a rule that you have to use 2 portions of this particular lentil and 1 portion of this particular lentil, and it has to be soaked at water at 25 degrees for precisely 7 hours. Absolutely not. Mm. It's reasonably flexible, and they all taste amazing. It doesn't matter which lentil you use. So perhaps one philosophical difference may be that, staying away from a set recipe perhaps engenders an element of diversity, which is eventually embraced based on the different regional agricultural practices, as opposed to, you know, being looked upon as some sort of imperfection, and converting cooking into some sort of a sport where you strive for that sort of technical perfection. I think that's perhaps one fundamental difference between some cuisines and cuisine in India.
But say in India, say if you, is there a difference, do you find a difference between the food that you eat out at a restaurant in India and the food that you would eat at home? Are things cooked differently, or would they be comparable?
So I think there are some differences, of course. So if I, the food that is made at home is not as rich and as, you know, heavy on fats, if you will. In some cases, the food tends to be more richer, heavier on fat. Mm. There is an element of presentation, so on and so forth. So I think broadly speaking, I would imagine that the food served at restaurants is somewhat different. But now I think we are seeing the revival of, you know, food that tastes just like home, that being served in restaurants, making a strong comeback. Because at the end of the day, it's about respecting the ingredient and respecting the simplicity of the dish sometimes. Just simple, clean flavors that you would get at home. But I'm not able to get that these days because, you know, India also experiences a lot of migration of people from one part to another. So I think now there's a lot of emphasis on home-cooked, home-style meals at, you know, a reasonable price. So the answer to your question is a bit complex. But I think on an average, if I were to step out, the food would tend to be different. And not only that, the assortment of the dishes that I cook would be far lower. So, for instance, if we take that Ade as an example, I would imagine 70% of the restaurants may not serve that on their menu. So that is also another difference.
I think Ajit is not too far away from the reservation here, is that because of how you grew up and your lifestyle, eating out was a luxury, right? It's not something you would do every day, like an occasion kind of a thing. When you, it's always more decadent, right? So when you, you know, like the curries will have, let's say, cashew paste in them and or heavy cream in them. So eating out is a lot more decadent because of that, and it's expensive, but it's okay because it's only once a while. Now it's the reverse because you know, you have a lot more people who are working long hours, people are living far away from home because cities are growing and a lot of these offices are away. So people don't have time to now cook at home compared to like when I was growing up in the 90s. So now you see people yearning for home cooked meals, like Ajit said, which is now giving rise to, and it's funny because the naming a lot of the restaurants, right, in the 90s, a lot of the restaurants would have the word Royal or Deluxe or a Palace in the name of the restaurant or some variation of that, right, because you want to give that image that you are coming into this. Yes. Now, if you look at a lot of restaurants, they have names like, oh, Grandma's Kitchen or variations of those. To give you a sense of, no, this is to take you back to, you know, your grandma's food or your mom's cooking. And it's things. So that's that tonal shift you're seeing. And with more and more people's lifestyles changing, this eating out is no longer a luxury like it was for us in the 90s. Now it's becoming second nature, like how it is in other parts of the world as well.
Mm. This is fascinating, completely fascinating, especially that change from the naming of restaurants. I've really enjoyed talking with you.
You probably amazing. See that in the UK as well. A lot of these restaurants will have the word Palace or something like that the names of the restaurants.
But they haven't gone over to home cooking yet.
No.
That is something that...
Not really.
Because I think we when we eat out, we still expect the Indian restaurant, the Chinese restaurant, to be a special experience. So whereas in Melbourne and in Australia, that family aspect is absolutely played up. One of my father's favorite restaurants is this one called Lau's Family Kitchen, the chef, the Lau family, had one of the most expensive Cantonese restaurants in Melbourne, or the most expensive, possibly one of the most expensive in the world. It was very, very expensive. But they then set up this kind of family place where they did family dishes, where a bowl was placed on the table. It was very much like eating at home. We haven't quite got to that place here. Not in London. We're starting to. Yep. And you know, maybe in the future it will be different. Certainly in the UK, where when we come out of this lockdown period, how we will approach. I mean, will people want to eat at a buffet? Will people want to sit in a restaurant? And is it possible to have family cooking delivered to you at home? Maybe it could be different. Maybe we can present things differently. You know, I love the idea that you could have sort of family style dishes that were delivered to you almost in the dishes, and then you return the dishes at the end or something like that. There's maybe someone could do your family home cooking and deliver it to you.
Yeah.
It could be different. It could be different.
I think what we can really hope is that this whole lockdown and the fact that food fundamentally tends to be a unifying force. I just sincerely hope that these times teach us to embrace diversity in pretty much anything and everything, and hopefully shed some of our prejudices, little by little, one day at a time, and look forward to a world that is more united, more diverse, and more respectful of people's choices.
Yes. Cheers to that. I think that's something I want to hold in my head, Ajit.
One of the things I've seen that people will take away from the lockdown is everyone will emerge from the lockdown as better home cooks, because you're being forced to cook, and then people are seeking variety, so they're trying different things. A lot of people are now forced to cook with meats or fresh vegetables, but if not, everyone's making sourdough. So yeast is not available. There is no yeast available in a lot of supermarkets. Flour isn't available.
It's so true.
Everyone's making sourdough. I blame you, Dan.
Look, on that note, can I say thank you, guys? This has been an amazing conversation. Really, really good. My head is spinning with ideas. I need to write them down. Thank you, Max. Thank you, Ajit. I hope you stay safe and come out of this lockdown really soon with lots of inspiration.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure having you, and thank you so much for giving us your time.
That's it, folks. That's our episode with Dan. Thank you again, Dan, for making time and being on the podcast. Like always, this is Max and Ajit signing off. You're listening to The Nerd Kitchen. Do find us on Spotify and let your friends know. Spread the word. Thank you so much. See you later. Bye-bye.